the last talk of the symposium today. I have about another minute. So for those of you who might have questions, please stay after the symposium during the break and talk to the presenters for this symposium today. I will talk a little bit about molecular databases and our future, and then I'll roll right into a summary of our symposium, and that'll be the end of the symposium. Okay? So my last talk will be about area identifiers' future role detecting invasive species, and we are looking at a national molecular database, whether we should have one. So questions have been raised. First of all, whether we need a molecular identification. I think that's well established that yes, we do need to include that into our system. A DNA database for interceptions would probably be very helpful across the United States, as well as maybe other countries as well. Can we use a current database that's out there? And what about accuracy and integrity? How do we ensure that? Privacy for our customers, the national, international brokers and customers. And what are appropriate uses of molecular tools for quarantine inspections at ports of entry? There's a lot of breaking ground out there right now. There are a lot of research studies that are going on, and there's a great deal of literature. But there's also a great deal of fear. The fear is that we are moving away from traditional taxonomy. We're becoming lab technicians without field experience. There are also some great advantages, and that is melding the morphological and the molecular relationships together, combining a significant reference collection of organisms, the molecular information, as well as digital libraries that we can use throughout the nation for interceptions. There are several current studies going on right now. One is detecting the bacteria in ACPs, that Asian citrus psyllid, that we find in surveys. The other one is to identify the larval stages from other larval stages of the light brown apple moth from other more native species. Also, Liriomyza wheatabrinsis, there's some molecular identification going on for the pupal and larval stages so that we can decipher between our native species here in our studies. We also look at the molecular identification of the cotton boll weevil, the invasive species, to identify it from our native cotton boll weevil. And then the identification, molecular identification between Planococcus citri and Planococcus minor in Hawaii, which was introduced in 2009. Most of the work is done through a central lab in California that may sub out to other molecular labs, but we also have a molecular lab in Maryland that does a lot of work as well. So if you'll allow me the stretch here, this is a DNA hurdle. We have many things that we have to think about in this particular aspect, and that is we need a lot of sequences, a lot of data for pest species for different locations and across the world in order to make that determination for identification. We need to prioritize which taxa we need to work with molecular analysis. We need, not all organisms are the same, so what genes do we express? What genes do we look at and isolate and analyze? We need rapid identification. As you heard in many of the talks today, we try to get an identification done within 24 hours. Is that possible with every molecular tool out there? And we do have some keys that are out in the public, publications that are available to us that have molecular identification, but again, we're talking about how useful are they at this point in time for us in interceptions. Roadblocks. The number one roadblock all the time is cost. How much does it take to set up a molecular lab? We're also looking at the fear that this is barcoding. This is not necessarily barcoding. This is an enhancement to morphological taxonomy, and we should use it as such, especially when we're talking about egg stages and larval stages. Where should we do extraction? this is an opportunity to take some privileges here if I can. I think that ports of entry would be an excellent way to start doing extraction processes and archiving that DNA someplace else for identification for future use. Do we need a central molecular lab? Do we need sublabs to do some of the work? Where should the DNA library be maintained? I talked about NCBI, that's a national database for molecular work right now. And then we have to talk about credibility. We also have to talk about privacy with our customers, international privacy. Ultimately, sequencing which genes, which organisms. Currently, we are moving in the right direction. We are amassing a huge digital imaging database. We're looking at morphological specimens on a regular basis and archiving those as well. But we're also starting to preserve in high-level ethanol for few DNA use in many ports of entry that know that this is the way we're going to end up moving at some point in time. So future will tell us whether we will have a molecular archive at some point in time. But currently, and I'm going to just take the liberty to read this because, as you know, most federal agencies have very long names, and once you figure out what the name meant in the title, then you forget what their purpose is. So I'm going to take the liberty of reading it. The Center of Plant Health Science and Technology has formed the Molecular Data Analysis Team to ascertain and work on what molecular tools and processes are appropriate for the agency's mission. They have been meeting, I think Joel can answer this question probably better than I, quite often to discuss the direction that they can take and where they will go. So in summary of the symposium, we are increasing our awareness for invasive species and pest risks. We are looking at ports of entry. We're looking at transferring information across our ports of entry between identifiers and with the support of national identification services and the support of agricultural research services, and a great working relationship with our Customs and Border Protection agencies. We are also looking at a great deal of rapid digital references. We have many committees with the CBP to look at pest risk pathways and risks of commodities, and we are highlighting those commodities for invasive species. We conduct a great deal of training throughout the regions at all of our ports of entry and our borders, and we highlight those in our pest risk meetings as well. So we work with many government agencies to help highlight pathways and risks, and we are embracing new tools to enhance our abilities to detect invasive species in the future, hopefully meeting the increase of our import-export business as we go. First of all, I'd like to thank everybody who did attend for the entire symposium or any of the talks, and I'd like to open this up to any questions that you might have. Any questions? I'm going to turn on the light. All of our speakers are still here, too.
propylene glycol?
I have tried it a couple of times. I haven't really experienced any difficulties with it.
Right.
Anybody else? I know you, South Emory, you've worked with quite a lot.
Yeah, you can use that stuff too. And I think we are now just testing out the rubbing alcohol that they're using in Florida.
Oh, it works fine,
yeah.
Right?
So.
What concentration?
I don't know, they buy these.
Just a 70 or
is it an isopropyl?
Yeah.
The isopropyl? Yeah. 70%?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, why not? I mean, we're talking about something that we hope to get DNA out of within a year, maybe. Maybe not archive it for 100 years, because even with ethanol, we're going to have to break.
Well, I think for some slide preparations, you can make the DNA extraction part of your preparation for your slide. And then if you do that, then you have both the targets.
Yeah.
And you've got the DNA, and it doesn't require much more time. It's just part of the cleaning process.
Right. That's what I did with regards to my work, is just clear it at the same time with DNA processing and not in an on spot. So you have both. Yes?
But along with the venture into molecular, which is excellent, what about a venture into the technology of software that's image matching pixel by pixel?
We certainly can do that too. I mean, the possibilities are endless at this point. Whether the agency will grab a hold of them and take advantage of this opportunity is another story.
How do you make that happen? That's really the point.
Yeah. How do you make that happen? That's the thing. I mean, maybe you can address it.
That's a tough one. I don't think it's there yet. We're going to get a big nose, it's mostly a weevil. Someday it could be.
No, I'm talking letting the machine match an unknown to a library.
Right, yeah. And I'm not sure we're there yet with the technology that we looked into about 2 years ago. Has stuff changed in a couple of years?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to talk to you about it. I'd like to talk with you about it.
Okay.
What about the practice of boiling the larvae for lepidoptera? Does that, and then does that affect the ability to get DNA?
You know, I don't know. I would think that it has some degree of
teenagers. Teenagers,
right. The question that was raised by Joel was, we have a process at the border when a larval nut is selected, they boil. So does that degrade the DNA, and should you take DNA prior to? And yes, I think the conclusion is that it does denature the protein. So you do end up losing your information as far as DNA is concerned. So that may be, no?
In many of these DNA extraction protocols, at the end, avoid in order to get rid of the protein escape.
Okay.
So it shouldn't affect the DNA.
Okay. So do you have an answer? No. It does not. Yes?
Jordan, there's a species of unknown species are medium-sized species of receptive for that region. How one of these identify what type of particle you can develop inside here? Are one of these identify the electronic, the name, the level, the level of the
you don't have a standardized process for analyzing every new introduction, but I mean, if an SEL scientist is working on a particular group, they might figure the DNA for that particular interception, something new, into the studies that they're doing. But as an agency, you don't do that as a matter of process.
Yes,
yep,
yellow. Sorry.
Taxonomic community would welcome traps that had less sticky or I know there are some traps now that don't use the tanglefoot. They use another material that's not as damaging. It's still as effective at catching it. For the left doctor, I mean, they use sticky traps a lot in monitoring known pest populations where they're looking for just pest levels, like, you know, cotton bollworm or whatever, and they just count them. They're not looking for the one exotic like they are with pest detection. So, you know, the purpose of the sticky trap was different than what it was actually being used for in our surveys. I mean, our taxonomists would really appreciate any alternative to sticky trap.
Okay, one question back here.
It's protected. You know, all kinds of privacy. You can't just open first-class mail. So, I mean, Colin, maybe you could speak to that. But I know from Hawaii, you know, we had a lot of evidence that fruit-fly material, host material, was being sent by mail to the mainland, and that might have been how they were getting a lot of fruit-fly introductions in Southern California. And we had to go to, I think we went to court or something to be able to open some of that mail. You know, even if we had evidence, if you have evidence that there's like a leaky package and the fruit is starting to rot, you can, they can open it up, but you can't just randomly, you know, look. And I think they're using dogs now. These dogs trained to smell out host material.
Yeah, the dogs at our ports of entry are pretty interesting. I'm sure they probably use them at the mail as well. But we have dogs who smell money, smell drugs. It's very interesting.
They smell fruit and vegetables.
And they smell fruit and vegetables. It's quite amazing.
We have trained on snails as well.
Yep. Anybody else have any other questions? Okay, before we go, oh, yes, go ahead.
In terms of taxonomic, taxonomic capability in the points of origin for this huge traffic and commerce of samples that end up in your labs. What could you do to set up formal collaboration, you know, with labs around the world who, you know, provide a lot of expertise in what is going to come, or what is coming this way, you know, whether it's conventional taxonomic, morphological taxonomy, or molecular taxonomy. From all these areas, produce, for example, fresh produce is coming from, it seems like you guys could gain a lot by collaborating directly with those scientists.
I am going to defer to Joe Tavy for that piece of information.
Yeah, that's a good question. There is a lot of expertise elsewhere. And in fact, a lot of it is unpublished information. As we all know, taxonomists have all of us do. Things in our head that didn't quite make it for publication, or things in some countries that just make it on the shelf at the university and they never get the funds to put these things out. There's an international movement to standardize protocols for certain major pests. Those are often, they may be morphological, more of them are molecular than not, but nowadays. So there's that collaboration. There is collaboration among the experts in SEL and our other experts that have their own networks, of course. I remember we sent a digital image one time to Italy, and in 45 minutes we had the identification of the species and the sample picture that was up there. So there's some of this going on, but I agree with you, Chuck, it could be a lot more than what we do. Maybe the problem is volume. You know, there's so many things coming at us. Who do you talk to? It's like, you know, if one really hits us hard enough, then all of a sudden the feelers go out. What you're talking about does occur. When a pest, Joel can tell you, when a pest like L-band gets into this country, there's foreign expert exchange almost, what, a week after, within a week of the find. So a lot of that does occur, but yeah, it's the, our biggest problem is we've got a myriad of things coming at us. Yeah, it's very hard, unless it's one that's pushed to the top of the priority for some political or other reason, it's very hard to had a lot of conversations about every one of these things.
Anybody else? We got one question, I'll come right back. Go ahead.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of effort in detecting this suspicion in the country. Are there any regulations or restrictions that the important country have to meet for the same product?
We've had several trade agreements, but I think you could probably, both of you could talk to that a lot better than I can.
Yeah, it's a lot of items are not even allowed into the country, because we know that inspection is something that will not detect the pests that we need to keep out. Certain plant diseases, for instance. Well, if you're getting a fruit that may have no symptoms on fruit, but my fruit may be a pathway. Well, the symptoms might come so late, you know, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of things that are outright prohibited. There are others where we know the pest is in a situation like fruit flies, where it's an internal feeder, we probably can't find it, and it's serious enough that we have to deal with it some other way. So there's a treatment that is required that we know will kill the pests. Cold treatments, sometimes methyl bromide treatments, sometimes it's packing house requirements that go on. So there's a lot of things that are kept out that way. But if you look at, those are all called mitigations, ways of mitigating the pests from getting there to here, right? In the international agreement, the IPBC is called, the International Agreement on How We Trade and what agriculture barriers might be there, says that you utilize the least restrictive mitigation measure necessary to exclude the pest. And usually the least measure is inspection. So the philosophy is that when the world has agreed to this, to keep trade going so that you don't shut everything down, that if you can use that least method inspection, then that's the one you should be using. If it doesn't cut it, make the argument and require some other more restrictive mitigation. So yeah, we do all that stuff, but we have to use, we can't just say, all right, there's too many of them coming over, we're going to. And then I will say one other thing. If the pest load on a given commodity from a given origin is so intensive that it's just unacceptable, you know, if it's going up to 10-15% of shipments, we know inspection doesn't get everything. And when propagule pressure, if you will, gets up to that kind of level, we start working with, even before that, we start working with the country, hey, come on, clean this act up. And if they're unable to do it or uncooperative in doing it, we will go to a higher mitigation and say, okay, that can't come in anymore unless it's fumigated. That can't come in until you've done something else. You've given us a phytosanitary certificate that says it's free of the pest, which means that government has to inspect it before it even comes over here. So that's kind of how we operate these things. A whole myriad of things in the first part gets in the way of all of it sometimes. And if you play with that game, too, it's not easy to make a relationship. Everybody told you what.
And so how rigidly can you guys require that? Something. Let's say if you now for 2 months, 3 months, you've gotten a heck of a lot of tests on a particular commodity, can you just, you know, demand immediate action, or is this something that has to go through all the different levels back, and by the time we already hit that test?
If we write a regulation to put in a more serious thing, it takes 2 years to get a regulation, but we can act immediately. Normally, though, we will work with the country first. And the idea is to try to get them to clean up their act. That's the best thing we can do, is get countries to clean up their export act. The last thing that we would do is something called a federal order, where we can put it in place pretty quickly. And it just says, from now on, this stuff from that country has to come in under these circumstances.